Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Die Erderhitzung ist kein Gefühl, aber mit vielen Gefühlen verbunden. Sorgen etwa oder Angst. Eine Veranstaltung gegen diese Ohnmacht ist Tipping Time, eine Klimakonferenz der Zivilgesellschaft. Von 9.5. bis 11.5. findet Tipping Time in Kooperation von Globe Art, Solektiv und Tangente St. Pölten statt und lädt ein zu Diskurs, Diskussionen und Workshops mit namhaften Vortragenden wie Nikolai Schulz und Friederike Otto. Weitere Informationen finden Sie auf www.tangentesanktpölten.at.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, im Falter Radio. Der Amazonas, Brasiliens Präsidentschaftswahlen und wir, das ist das Thema dieser Sendung. Sonntag, den 2. Oktober, wählt Brasilien einen neuen Präsidenten und ein neues Parlament. Der rechtsrechte Amtsinhaber Jair Bolsonaro kämpft um seine Wiederwahl. Aber der linke Vorvorgänger, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, hat gute Chancen auf ein Comeback. Bolsonaro gibt sich als brasilianischer Trump. Sollte er verlieren, dann wäre das ein Beweis, dass die Wahlen getürkt sind, tönte er vor seinen Fans, ganz nach der Methode Trump. Es geht um viel, nicht nur für das riesige Land selbst, sondern für die Menschheit. Denn die Entwaldung des Amazonas hat in der rechtsextremen Präsidentschaft massiv zugenommen. Der Amazonas ist der größte tropische Regenwald der Welt. Er reguliert ganz entscheidend das globale Klima. Der Amazonas erstreckt sich über 8 Länder, beherbergt 60% der Tropenwälder der Welt, 20% aller Süßwasserreserven und 10% der gesamten Biodiversität. Nicht zuletzt aufgrund der Entscheidungen oder auch der Nichtentscheidungen des noch amtierenden Präsidenten Brasiliens Bolsonaro ist die grüne Lunge der Erde in höchster Gefahr. Sein Gegner Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, Mitbegründer der brasilianischen Arbeiterpartei, hat schon zwischen 2003 und 2011 das Land regiert. Katharina Kropshofer hat den Politikwissenschaftler und Gründer des brasilianischen Thinktanks Igarapé-Institute Robert Moga gefragt, was auf dem Spiel steht.
And it's important to you know, before we even talk about Bolsonaro, to recognize that in there is a system in Brazil and in parts of Colombia and in Peru that predates Bolsonaro, that has facilitated, in some cases enabled, this kind of criminality to take place. So what has Bolsonaro done? Bolsonaro, since coming into office, has systematically dismantled protected areas and indigenous territories that had been set up in previous administrations. He's provided, as of previous administrations, amnesties for people who've been accused of illegally deforesting land or illegally mining. He's protected garimpeiros, who are the wildcat miners, who form, by the way, a big part of his political base. He is denuded, defunded environmental law enforcement agencies, including IBAMA, which is the major environmental protection agency of Brazil. He's defunded and replaced the heads of other types of agencies that provide protections, including FUNAI, which is the agency responsible for indigenous affairs. And perhaps, you know, in a way, almost worst of all, he's created a culture or a climate for farmers and ranchers and others in the region to really act with impunity, you know, in many cases to set the forest on fire. He's also sort of launched a kind of war on not just environmental institutions, but democratic institutions. So he's really stopped the establishment of even new nature indigenous reserves. He's staffed a lot of the agencies with his loyalists. He's ramped up a campaign against environmentalists and indigenous defenders, which now makes Brazil one of the most dangerous countries in the world, according to Global Witness and other environmental organizations, for being an environmentalist. And this has had all sorts of consequences, both, at home, but also abroad. You know, for example, Norway and Germany ended funding for, or suspended funding for, something called the Amazon Fund, which was a billion-dollar reforestation and nature-based solution mechanism. So I think what we've seen is really almost like a blitzkrieg of decrees and policies and acts that have resulted in dismantling of Brazil's once quite robust set of checks and balances around protecting the Amazon. And so, you know, as we look towards the October 2022 election, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that this could decide the fate of the Amazon basin.
Die Zukunft des Amazonas liegt also womöglich, ob Sie es wollen oder nicht und ob Sie sich darüber bewusst sind oder nicht, in den Händen der brasilianischen Wähler. Die guten Nachrichten? Lula liegt in den Umfragen vorne und er hat bereits in seinen vergangenen Amtszeiten mit Hilfe seiner Umweltministerin Marina Silva bewiesen, dass ihm der Stopp der Abholzung ein Anliegen ist. Diese sank während seiner Amtszeit um mehr als 84%. Er kurbelte die grüne Wirtschaft an, stärkte die Wissenschaft. Und nun hat er auch versprochen, wieder mehr Schutzgebiete für die wertvolle Flora und Fauna, aber auch für indigene Gruppen einzurichten, die sich teilweise an der Front eines Krieges um den Amazonas finden. Was aber steht genau auf dem Spiel und wieso konzentriert sich MAGA genau jetzt darauf?
Over the last couple of years, I've expanded my focus to what you might describe as unstoppable trends. You know, things like digital transformation, the extraordinary polarization we're seeing around the world. And of course, the big one, climate change. And I wrote a book a couple of years ago that brings 10 big mega trends together, which explores really the past, the present, and the future of our biggest systemic risks. And what I came to realize in writing this book was that a lot of these trends were converging in this thing called the Amazon Basin. And the Amazon Basin, which we're going to talk about today, is the world's largest tropical rainforest. But it's fundamentally connected to big megatrends like globalization through trade and increasingly digital connectivity. It's enmeshed in a global system of commodities, home to some of the biggest rare earth supplies, nickel, lithium, gold. It's got soy, cattle, sugar, timber. We're seeing people think of the Amazon as this big, vast, and spoiled area of green, but actually it's been inhabited for thousands of years. And what we're seeing is a growing number of smaller, medium-sized, and big cities. And it's got, you know, massive in-migration as the hunt for resources expands. And it's becoming, as a result, one of the most violent places in Brazil.
Der Amazonas wird abgeholzt, in unglaublicher Geschwindigkeit. Seit dem Jahr 1990 waren es mehr als 400.000 Quadratkilometer Wald. Das entspricht einer Fläche in etwas so groß wie die der Staatsgebiete von Deutschland und Dänemark zusammen. Robert Mugger erklärt, was die ökologische Bedeutung des Waldes ist und was passieren könnte, wenn dieser plötzlich kippt.
Well, I think the first thing to say, Catherine, is that the Amazon is vast. It's enormous. Just to put this in perspective, for your listeners who may not be familiar with the sheer scope and scale, it's 7 million square kilometers. It spans 8 countries, huge countries like Brazil, Colombia, and Peru, but also smaller ones like Bolivia, Ecuador, Suriname, Guyana, and Venezuela. What that means is the Amazon is bigger than all of Western Europe. You could fit 80 Austrias in the Amazon. So it is an incredibly important ecosystem. And we're facing in the Amazon the real risk of what we call a dieback scenario. And this dieback, which sounds as ominous as it is tied to heat stress, dryness, declines in water vapor, and ultimately in forest decline. But the point is that the Amazon, which is this huge, vast forest, and provides an enormous amount of oxygen and cycles an enormous amount of carbon dioxide, is this carbon sink. But it's close to this tipping point, which would turn the world's biggest carbon sink into one of its largest carbon emitters. I think, you know, just to kind of break it down a bit, the Amazon, often we think of it as this massive forest spanning all of these countries, but it's useful to think of it as a series of smaller regions. And if I take Brazil, for example, which is home to the majority of the Amazon, we call it the legal Amazon in Brazil. We have the northern part of the Amazon, the eastern part of the Amazon, and the southern part of the Amazon. And some parts are more at risk than others. There are two very famous scientists, Carlos Nobre and the late Thomas Lovejoy, who theorized that the Amazon would tip over from being the world's largest tropical forest to being one of its largest savannas if between 20 and 25% of the forest cover was lost. Scientists that are leveraging satellite data and drones and other remote sensing estimate that we're probably at about 18% of the Amazon now being deforested. So in other words, we're just a few percentage points away, give or take, from this catastrophic scenario. And I guess the bottom line here is that, you know, what happens in the Amazon doesn't stay in the Amazon. The collapse of the Amazon would be catastrophic, not just for local ecosystems and biodiversity, but it has huge implications for global warming, for climate change. The turning of the tropical forest into savanna would mean that the world's largest carbon sink is in decline. We would see it flip from being a net carbon sink to a carbon source. And what we'd then see is deforestation intensifying in dry seasons, reducing rainfall, exacerbating ecosystem stress, and then fires. And this would spew as much as 90 billion metric tons of carbon. That's about 7 years worth of all human emissions. And this could result in a global tipping point, contributing to more heat waves and droughts and changes in atmospheric movements and ocean currents.
Kippt der Amazonas? Gibt er also mehr Kohlendioxid ab, als er speichern kann? Werden wir die Auswirkungen auf der ganzen Welt bemerken? Veränderte Ozeanströmungen, veränderte Wetterphänomene. Die Pariser Klimaziele werden dann ziemlich sicher Geschichte. Doch Robert Mugger spricht auch von Resilienz. Von Teilen, vor allem im Süden des Amazonas, die sich wieder erholen. Insofern man die Abholzung dort eindämmt und den Wald, wenn dann, nur nachhaltig bewirtschaftet. Doch das erfordert den Einsatz von mächtigen Regularien, Überprüfungsmechanismen, Transparenz. Denn 95% der Abholzung geschieht momentan illegal. Wer sind die Leute, die Bäume umschneiden?
Let's talk a bit about the Amazon and the people who live there. Because I think, there's such an emphasis in certainly amongst the kind of environmental community and others who are seized and concerned with the Amazon of preserving flora and fauna that we often forget or maybe trivialize the populations that live there. And I think it's important to recognize that there are upwards of 30, 35 million people in the Brazilian Amazon alone. And they come from all manner of places. I mean, we have European descendants who came during colonization period. And there's hundreds of indigenous groups, some of them uncontacted. We have Afro-Brazilian communities. These are people who came over, were enslaved, and were brought to the Amazon to tap rubber or to produce coffee. I think that many have been drawn to the Amazon and supported to migrate there or migrate on their own. In parallel with the growing appetite globally for commodities. And right now, Brazil, which is an agro superpower and a mining giant, has started to tap the Amazon for a range of these commodities that are of enormous interest to growing appetites in China, Europe, North America, and of course within Brazil, which is a continent-sized country in its own right. So, across Colombia, Peru, and Brazil, you've got appetite for soy, for corn, for sugar, most importantly for cattle. Brazil's one of the largest cattle producers, palm oil. But then we're also talking about gold and nickel and cobalt. And increasingly now we're seeing lithium being of interest. So as appetite and for commodities grows, so too the pressure on the Amazon. And so it's not just about locals who are cutting down trees to make way for villages and towns and cities. But also large agro-industrial, companies that are and mining companies that are investing in the access to land, the clearing of land, and then ultimately the use of land, and the sheer scale of the deforestation, really, it's breathtaking, right? I mean, I think it's really important to emphasize this. Like this year, we've seen the highest rate of deforestation in 15 years, over 13,000 square kilometers. It's about the fifth the size of Austria. And deforestation has increased 70% since Bolsonaro took office. So a lot of this, the vast majority of this land grabbing, deforestation, the washing of commodities into essentially legitimate supply chains has legal dimensions to it. And the illegality runs from the investors who are essentially paying people to colonize land. It involves the brokers who supply the licenses and often have corrupt practices around the buying and selling of land registries. It's the police who are often complicit in allowing these activities to happen and may themselves be profiting from it. It's the local officials in cities that have economies that are run off these black markets and associated, secondary economies. And it's frankly the investors, traders, and purchasers who, despite the advent of ESG and despite the advent of, a push towards a greener economy, are still allowing dodgy commodities to enter our supply chains and be sold in markets across Europe and North America. So, I think what we can say is that it's a single mafioso or a single criminal who's at the, center. It's a highly distributed, highly decentralized and widespread array of criminality. And, what I'd argue is that Brazil is really ground zero for a lot of this. I think aided and abetted to some extent by Bolsonaro, the climate denier in chief.
Bolsonaros Politik bedroht aber nicht nur die Biodiversität des Urwalds. Auch die Rechte und geschützten Gebiete von indigenen Gemeinschaften wurden in den letzten Jahren massiv eingeschränkt. Welchen Beitrag können Indigene generell für den Erhalt des Regenwalds leisten?
So there are at least 300 indigenous communities distributed across Brazil alone, hundreds more in Peru, Colombia, and the other countries of the Amazon, many of whom are deeply invested in protecting and preserving the forests. And they are also, though, amongst the most vulnerable to the encroachments of these major players we discussed, be it agricultural companies or mining groups or wildlife traffickers. Scientific studies, sort of hard natural science studies and social science studies show that indigenous groups play a really fundamental role in preserving and maintaining the integrity of ecosystems. But we're also seeing that they are easily sidestepped. And so giving platforms and voice, providing systems to build to support networks, especially for women in environmental defenders who are facing threats from all sides, external and often inside their communities, is really important. But I think the reality right now, as I mentioned, is that we're seeing that the growing number of indigenous and environmental defenders are being targeted precisely because they play this fundamental role, precisely because they're, in a way, the human sensors that are alerting the world to what's happening. And as a result, killings, intimidation, harassment have skyrocketed in Brazil, Colombia, Ecuador, and Peru. Bruno Pereira, who is working for FUNAI, Don Phillips, who is a journalist with the, part-time journalist of The Guardian. These are just, cases, but there are dozens and dozens and dozens of leaders who've been killed. And Brazil, in particular, where I live, is the fourth most dangerous country right now in the world for environmental activists. So one of the things we're doing at my institute is, in addition to monitoring the threats and working with business and government to try to think about nature-based solutions and working with police and prosecutors to improve trans-border cooperation, is working directly with indigenous women networks. So we're supporting 14 high-profile indigenous activists in the Amazon, helping them both in terms of being able to document the kinds of threats and risks they face, because they're, often that's missed, but also helping them with their own online and offline protection. The level of knowledge and awareness of forest ecosystems and biodiversity is extraordinary. We only know something like 1% of the biodiversity of the Amazon. And if you spend any time with communities in Pará or Amazonas or Rondônia, it's bewildering, the wisdom and the array of insights that locals have about the environment around them. And so so it's not, you know, I think understanding indigenous communities not as passive actors or wholly as victims, but also as agents in the transformation of the Amazon, in the bioeconomy of the Amazon, in sourcing, you know, new ingredients for synthetic biology, for biotechnology, for pharmacology. I think we're only starting to sort of understand that this extraordinary wisdom's there. And there's also one final thing, which I think is not just related to indigenous in the Amazon, but globally, including in, you know, Europe and North America and elsewhere, is that many indigenous communities see the world as an integrated whole, as hyper-connected. They understand the value of mother trees in relation to other trees and ecosystems. They recognize the importance of harvesting only what you need. There's a very strong sense of consciousness about, you know, the integrity and keeping intact existing systems. And there's this understanding and consciousness about the future, about future generations. We talk about 6, 7, 8 generations in the future and living in a way that's according not just with the past, but also looking towards the unborn. And I think this sentiment is becoming more pervasive in global circuits as well. The UN, for example, and the new Secretary General's new report, Our Common Agenda, calls for a summit of the future in 2024. And a big concern that's being raised is, how do we think about preserving all of our ecosystems and common properties and common resources in ways that will secure our future, not just for our children, but our children's children and multiple generations beyond.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Maga spricht von dem Einfluss der brasilianischen Politik, der wichtigen Hilfestellung von indigenen Communities und auch von dem Beitrag, den er und seine Organisation leisten. Mit Hilfe von Satellitendaten zeigen sie quasi in Echtzeit auf, wo und vor allem auch welche Art von Abholzung geschieht. Dann überlagern sie das mit Daten über Kriminalität und machen so transparent, wo die Hotspots der Illegalität liegen. Eine Ressource für die lokale Politik, aber auch für die EU, die durch den Import von Gütern wie Soja, Holz oder Rindfleisch aus dem Amazonasgebiet ihren Anteil an der Umweltzerstörung hat. In Zahlen? Die EU ist für 16% der globalen Entwaldung von Regenwäldern verantwortlich. Nun hat das EU-Parlament für ein Gesetz gestimmt, das diesen Prozess eindämmen soll. Wie sehr könnte das Problem im Amazonas lösen?
This is maybe the green lining of this rather gloomy tale that, you know, I've been telling. And I think the European Union effort is really important. The European Parliament just passed, as you said, new anti-deforestation laws that would ban products that are linked to deforestation and degradation of forests, as well as products that are linked to human rights violations. So it does, in a way, exactly what I think we're calling for, which is require that companies that do business in Europe and that draw on commodities from major tropical forest biomes are conscious of what is happening across their supply chains when it comes to not just the environmental side, the biodiversity side, but also the human rights side. Of course, the proof will be in the pudding. Can these wondrous regulations be enforced? That, I think, is the big question mark. And I think the good news is that, you know, the so-called Brussels effect, the effect of European Union legislation on behavior of markets, can often yield some positive outcomes. So I think it's an important start. It's a critical step, but it's only a first step. We're going to need to see similar kinds of activities being enacted in North America and other markets. We're going to have to put a lot of pressure on Asia and China in particular, which is driving a lot of the sort of demand for these commodities. But I think it's a really important step. For too long, it's been very episodic. Every couple of years, people get very upset because there's a lot of smoke coming out of the Amazon, and then it dissipates. I think what we're seeing now is a community, an ecosystem of actors, if you will, that are really stepping up and growing, and most importantly, people coming from the region itself who are becoming advocates. And we're seeing more Indigenous voices. We're seeing more scientists. We're seeing business leaders who are stepping up and forming coalitions and consortia to talk about how to implement ESG, which was unheard of 5-10 years ago. We're seeing some industry leaders also investing in agro, you know, sustainable agroforestry. But again, we need scale. We need more than just the periodic flag waving. We need to have a regular drumbeat of action. We've already spoken as well about the extraordinary technologies that are emerging that are allowing the world to understand better what's happening and have a more sophisticated understanding. Let's just hope it's not too late. But if I were to kind of run through the actors, we have on the one hand this global advocacy. On the other, we have a growing number of institutional investors, and including development banks, that are also stepping up on the Amazon. Both the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank are supporting a kind of cluster of green funds and looking to accelerate nature-positive investment. The EU, we've already talked about, but that's a really important block that's taking action. We have something called ACTO, which is the Amazon Treaty Organization, which sort of is a consortium of the 8 countries plus one territory in the Amazon that are looking to develop more legislation and norms and action. It was born weak. You know, it was born in a different era, this organization. But I think there's growing evidence that there's support for this organization is going to be expanded. We're seeing a number of governments stepping up in the region. Brazil, I think, being the great exception, but that could change. But Colombia's new government under Petro has made a very strong case for more protection of the Amazon and cracking down on, especially on oil companies and illegal palm production. We're seeing really excitingly governors and mayors across the region also forging alliances and showing up at these big major events to draw attention to the Amazon, because we know that at the end of the day, you can make all the proclamations and declarations you want, but if you don't have local implementation, you're not going to go anywhere. We're also seeing, you know, the big commodity and financial players, and one has to kind of approach this with a grain of salt because they themselves have been involved in a lot of the deforestation. But we're seeing big companies, and I want to say this cautiously, but companies like BlackRock and Vanguard and JBS, the big meat packing companies, which have been traditionally responsible or at least implicated in large-scale deforestation or investing in companies that are involved in large-scale deforestation, along with a vast array of other financial players, starting to explore ways to advance investment in reforestation, rewilding, nature-based solutions, carbon offsets. There's a lot of concern about greenwashing, and we can get into that. But I think that, you know, there's definitely been a change in the conversation and a tone, and there's an enormous amount of money that's floating around that's looking to be allocated towards, you know, investments in this space. And this is sort of associated with this rush underway, this green rush, you could call it, in the wake of carbon and biodiversity credits. You know, companies around the world, including in Europe, are looking to offset their carbon and reduce their emissions. And a big expectation among some first movers in Brazil is that it could become kind of the new green Saudi Arabia, right? With the rollout of different projects around carbon sequestration or preserving forests essentially in return for payment. And there's a whole debate around the viability of that, around the effectiveness of that. But where I guess I'm most excited in terms of the longer term solutions, you know, in the midst of all this advocacy and activism and government action and business interest, is this discussion that we're having around a bioeconomy. You know, we've had this sort of dichotomy between conservation and development for a long time. And, you know, there's a whole constituency of purists who believe that forests must remain intact and they free of human intervention. And then there's another group that says, no, forests must be sacrificed to the altar of development. And it's all about expanding livelihoods and people's interests in the forest. And of course, the answer is probably somewhere in the middle or some combination of the two. We need to sort of revalue the forests and understand the potential of sustainable forest economies. And there's a group of scientists and environmental activists and business types and government folks who are talking about something called an Amazon 4.0, which is really about reimagining how do we think about sustainable mixed forest economies that rapidly reforest, but also value the extraordinary richness and biodiversity of what these forests have to offer, from nuts and berries to cosmetics to, you know, biotech to pharmaceutical products. There's a real risk here of greenwashing, you know, of governments and companies sort of seeming to take action when not actually cutting their emissions or profiting and extracting IP from these areas while not giving back to communities. These are big, big issues, which is why it's so important to have accountability and transparency in this process. There's a lot more that we haven't dug into in terms of activities, but I think the point I want to leave is that there is this rather almost bewildering array of initiatives that are underway right now, and a growing recognition of the seriousness of the crisis we're in. I think an appreciation, though not sufficient, that we're really in a race against time.
Das war ein Gespräch von Katharina Kropshofer mit dem Politikwissenschaftler Robert Mugger. Ich verabschiede mich von allen, die uns auf UKW hören, im Freirad Tirol und auf Radio Agora in Kärnten. Informationen und Analysen zu Klimaschutz und Politik lesen Sie jede Woche im Falter. Alle Informationen über Abonnements oder Probeabos finden Sie im Internet unter abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer hat die Signation gestaltet. Philipp Dietrich betreut die Audiotechnik im Falter. Ich verabschiede mich bis zur nächsten Sendung.
Die Erderhitzung ist kein Gefühl, aber mit vielen Gefühlen verbunden. Sorgen etwa oder Angst. Eine Veranstaltung gegen diese Ohnmacht ist Tipping Time, eine Klimakonferenz der Zivilgesellschaft. Von 9.5. bis 11.5. findet Tipping Time in Kooperation von Globe Art, Solektiv und Tangente St. Pölten statt und lädt ein zu Diskurs, Diskussionen und Workshops mit namhaften Vortragenden wie Nikolai Schulz und Friederike Otto. Weitere Informationen finden Sie auf www.tangentesanktpölten.at.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.